I don't think we ever realized we were out of bounds
until you caught the plane. Yeah.
All right. Hey, everyone. So welcome to the first episode of Camber Up. This is our new podcast series where we're going to be chatting, you know, with some of the best RC glider pilots, designers, and event organizers around the world. So throughout these series, we're going to have a chance to check out how different pilots set up their models. We'll talk about how they approach things like ballast, contest preparation, and training. We'll get a chance to talk to different designers and builders to get a better understanding of the planes that they've designed and their design philosophy. And we'll chat with organizers to gain some insight on what goes on behind the scenes. So the idea for Camber Up, it really only just came up very recently during a call with Gavin Trussell from Ohio. And so today I'm really excited to have Gavin with us as our very first guest. So I've known Gavin since around 2011 or 2012 when I first went to the Poway event in California. And he's probably one of the most well-known and successful DLG pilots in the US. Hey Gavin, thanks for joining us for our very first episode of Camber Up. For those in the audience who might not know you, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? You know, like what you do, how long you've been flying, and what kind of disciplines you mainly fly?
Sure. My name is Gavin Trussell. I've been flying RC for 15 to 18 years. I started when I was younger, but I kind of left it. It was too expensive. And then when I became a young man, I started flying gliders again a couple different ways. I fly multiple disciplines, and I also fly power planes for fun too, go to events. I am a sponsored pilot for Armsor, your company, and Horizon Hobbies, and a server company, KST, and a few other companies. I work for Honda, Honda Motor Cars, in their aero division at a new wind tunnel just being built. And so that's what I do for a living. That's what I do. I travel a lot, flying in events all over the United States, and have been quite a few places in the world flying with my son when he was younger, and flew for the U.S. team. So, yeah, pretty decent background in the U.S. soaring scene.
Well, speaking of events, this video is going to be coming out on Monday. I was going to be talking to you while I was asking for Friday or something, but you're actually going to be going to another event.
Right. Yeah, this time of year is really, really busy for me. So this weekend is Mid-South, and that is at Triple Tree Aerodrome, beautiful place in Woodruff, I think it's South Carolina. I know how to get there, but I always get to Carolinas backwards, north and south. So it's a 5J event and a TD event, they're still pushing the old winch planes in kind of like a 3J with winches, but they're allowing the 5J planes to compete as well. So that's a 3-day event at a really nice place. It's a really laid back event. It's more of a take your family there and enjoy the atmosphere and friends and stuff. It's super competitive, but it's still a really good time. So yeah. And the weekend after that is Cincinnati. Weekend after that is Jet Jam, and then it just keeps going and going and going. It's almost every weekend. I think I do about 25 events a year. So 25 weekends a year that I fly, either for either in sailplanes or other things.
You have no idea how jealous I am right now, because we've been stuck here for over a year, and we're probably not going to be going to any events this year either. It's just we can't travel.
You know when? You know, I don't know when they'll open that up, but they need to open that up soon so you can come see us.
I hope so. I'm really looking forward to come to the East Coast. I don't think I've ever been to Ohio, or I think the only place I've been on the East Coast was Kentucky for the Bruce, and that was a number of years ago.
That's same as Ohio. Basically, you're just a little south of us, but yeah, for the Bruce. Yeah, I remember that. I remember that well. That's an amazing time. But all right, so yeah, that's enough about me. Well, I guess it's a lot of it. So I guess let's get started.
Yeah, well, you know, talking to you, I think one of the things you're really known for, especially in the US, is, as you said, you go to probably half the weekends of the year, you're at a contest somewhere along either the East Coast or West Coast or anywhere in between. And I think there's probably going to be a lot of people, you know, watching this. I mean, probably a lot have flown contests, but there's quite a few who have never been to a contest. So I think in today's episode, as the first episode, let's talk a little bit more about, you know, competitions, DLG competitions. It might not even be DLG competitions. I think the contests in general in RC Soaring. What should people expect if they're going to their first event?
For like their first event, like let's just say they're going to their very first event, what would they say? Well, I would say the number one thing would be don't be intimidated. As intimidating as a competition sounds, you're going to go to your first competition. It is intimidating. There's no way around it.
I was so intimidated when I first started. I didn't even tell anyone around me I started flying DLGs. And the first time I went to the field, I crashed my brand new plane and I went to go home after the second flight.
I've done that. I did that so many times. In fact, the first competition I went to, I showed up with a plane in my car. I got out. I started walking around and I watched everyone. And I was so intimidated that I didn't even get my plane out of my car. I watched for half the day and I left. But, you know, now that I know what I know and I've been to so many, I wish I hadn't, because someone there would have taken me under their wing. And they would have explained a lot of things and helped me out. And I would have just started my career in soaring that much sooner. So, you know, when I say don't be intimidated, try not to be, you know, get out, find the contest director. We call them a CD. Find the contest director, explain to them who you are and say that you're going to be here, you know, pay your fee or whatever. Or maybe you've already signed up for it online. And then find a suitable place that, you know, everyone is going to be in kind of like a big long line. And so park your car. And then, you know, start either watching and learning and, you know, put your plan together and ask for help. Ask for help. Everybody there will be so nice and they will all help you figure out what's going on, how it's going to work, the rhythm of the contest, you know, how it's scored, how you get a timer, things like that. It's not, it sounds like it's a lot, but you'll notice that, you know, now that you, like you, Thomas, have done it so much, you don't even think about it. You just show up. You could go to a contest anywhere in the world, not know anybody, and it would just, you would just like start, you know.
Well, and I think one of the things is because people hear the word contest and it sounds really formal. It sounds almost elitist, right? You have to be a certain level to go. But in reality, these so-called contests are more like fun fly events, but with a little bit of a structure to it.
Sure. You
know, I don't think I've been to any atmosphere. The social atmosphere is just through the roof. It's awesome.
Right.
And you're not going to be able to go to any other event in any other hobby or sports where you, as a complete beginner, you can show up at an event and the next thing you know, you'll have the one of the top pilots in the world helping you out, you know, maybe getting your plane set up for you. And that's another thing. Like if you go to your first event, maybe your plane isn't set up to its full potential if you're just flying by yourself.
Sure,
and
sure.
Going to your first event, that's where, you know, people will be able to help you out, right?
Yeah, the old saying is you don't know what you don't know. And there's going to be so many things that you don't know, but you're going to learn very quickly. And after your first contest, flying in a competition makes you a better pilot. And hands down, you will become a much better pilot. And I tell, and it just happened at my local field. I have a couple guys that are just decided they were going to start flying competitively. And so they started buying better planes and they started competing. And next thing you know, I'm like, they're right there with me. I mean, they're duking it out every weekend. And I'm like, wow, where did this guy come from? You know? And I didn't realize that I created this monster. And it just happened that, you know, within the span of one season, their flying abilities went from maybe like a weekend warrior kind of rookie, someone I would never even look over at. Like, I need to watch his score. I need to watch what he's doing because he's getting really good to the point where I'm like, now I have to watch him and make sure that he doesn't get away from me. And, you know, he could easily catch me if I made a mistake and beat me on the weekend. So it's, and you gain knowledge and you get confidence. That's another thing that comes with flying in competitions is confidence. You'll gain confidence and it'll come on fast. And with learning different aspects of how you're flying, you'll push boundaries that you didn't know you had. when I first started, I was terrified, and I was terrified to fly across like power lines, over trees, you know, far downwind. I'm like, oh, I'll never get my plane back. I'll lose it. And now you don't even think about it. You'll fly so far away that you're like, people are like,
half the time you're flying, I can't even see the plane.
Right. So yeah. Right. So it's just something. Confidence comes with practice, and it's just more practice. And that's something you can't do enough is practice, you know.
And one of the things is when you're flying by yourself, you don't know if it's the air that's not good or whether you just couldn't catch that thermal. And when you're flying in a group, especially in a competition environment, and again, competition because it's quite laid back, you see what is possible in the air. Like if it's overcast, maybe when you're flying by yourself, it's like, hey, you know what? I'm getting a minute, 30 seconds, maybe a minute flights. The air must suck. Mm-hmm. But then when you go out and you see people hitting 2-3 minute flights in the same air that you would normally give up in, now you start to pick up the little hints on where the thermal is, why people are going to those spots. And that learning process, I think, is just incredible. Like everything speeds up.
Yeah, very much amplified. Competition brings out the, you know, the best in everybody, I think. And the one thing you'll notice about the soaring community is I did a lot of things. I played professional paintball when I was younger, and it was just a different atmosphere. But when I got into soaring, I realized that, wow, these guys, all these guys I compete against are all top level professionals in their own respective industries, like, you know, doctors and lawyers and pilots for, you know, airlines. And these guys are, you know, they've got their lives together. They're really good. And then they do this on the weekend for fun. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. You know, who am I? I'm just this nerd that works at Honda. But, so yeah, I think that your level of piloting skills just after your first event will probably double because you'll understand the lingo. You'll push boundaries. You'll gain confidence and competence. And then, it'll just start steamrolling from there. And the other thing is you will make friends all over the country and all over the world that you would have never thought you had. You'll have you'll just can't wait for the next weekend to go so you can see friends that you don't get to see all the time.
It's probably one of the most important aspects of it for me. I'm pretty lazy. I don't, practice or train as much as I probably should. So it's pretty rare for me to get on the podium at a big event, but I still love going to the big events because all my friends are there. We'll have guys from Germany or the UK, Australia, China, everywhere. Everyone's going to be at that event. And it's something at least I really look forward to throughout the year. And again, like the past year and a half, it's just been really tough for me personally because it's not being able to see everyone.
Right, right. Yeah, it's amazing. This flying on the being the junior team captain for the Worlds, and I think I know it's hard for the dates. Maybe 14 and 17, I think it was, or my son, and now he has friends all over the world too that he still communicates with. Kids that he competed against are now grown young men. You know, my boys, you know, just finishing up college. He's 23 years old. He was 16 when he started, 14 actually when he started in. And now he has these people that, you know, if he went anywhere in the world, he probably knows somebody pretty close that he could call and be like, hey, I'm in town, you know, you want to hang out? And they couldn't wait to see him. You know, it's a pretty amazing thing soaring has brought into my life.
I would have never thought when I first started to, know people all over the world like this either. Absolutely. Like sometimes if I'm going to another country, I need a place to crash. And quite often there's going to be someone, to hang out with, sleep for the night and then go on to the next place and just, have fun along the way. It's very rare, especially in this day and age where, everyone's kind of pitted against everyone else. And then there's this one thing that is bringing everyone back together.
Right, right. Yeah. It's, in a couple of weeks, I have a buddy coming from Arizona. I'll pick him up at the airport and we'll drive down to House Mountain, Tennessee for a 5J tournament or contest. And then a couple months after that, I'll fly into Phoenix and he'll pick me up and he'll put me up at his house and we'll go out and we'll fly at his contest, And so, and that's an incredible thing. I didn't know I was going to have friends, all over the country where I was going to just hang out with these guys. And I can't wait to see them. There's going to be so many guys this weekend that I haven't seen for a long time because of COVID. And we're just going to have an amazing time. It's going to be fun.
Before we continue, if you enjoy this content, hit the share button so your friends can watch it too. 5 seconds of your time goes a long way in helping our channel grow. Let's say we convinced you to go to your first contest. Now, what are some of the etiquettes that people should be aware of? The first one that pops in my mind is blue sky rule.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
What blue sky rule means is if you're flying and someone else is flying near you, because you're always probably going to be flying in clumps,
right?
Then just make sure there's always a little bit of blue sky between you and your plane and someone else's plane. That way you would never cross paths and hit each other.
Right. Midairs are avoidable, but they still happen. And they happen quite frequently, more than you would think. These little planes that hit each other in the air, and you're like, how does that happen? But it does happen.
The sky is so big.
Right. Like, yeah, but there's only so, you know, the lifting air, what we call thermal, it's only so much of it in one place. It's not everywhere. Sometimes it is, but most of the time it's a very small column of air, and a lot of planes want to be in that same column. The other part of the blue sky rule is top plane decides rotation. So if there's a if there's a stack of planes and they're all circling, the top plane decides the rotation. And what that means is, so that if every plane is circling, you know, one's doing clockwise, one's doing counterclockwise, if they do meet, they meet head on. And that's a really damaging, dangerous thing for these planes to hit because they're so light and fragile. So the top plane decides rotation. If he's turning counterclockwise and you're right below him, you should be turning counterclockwise. That way you can keep on the other side of the circle, the 180-degree side of the circle, be in the same air, share the same lifting air, but have a smaller chance of hitting each other. So that's one of the etiquettes. The other etiquette that I see beginner pilots do all the time is during practice. This is a big one. Is during practice, when you're on the field, and if you're new, or even if you're a seasoned veteran, try not to fly over the field during practice while people are launching, because there's no set time for someone to launch. So if you're just flying over the field coming towards yourself and you're flying over other pilots and someone launches, they launch straight into you. And it's happened so many times. I've seen so many people lose their planes because they were flying just, you know, innocently over the field and someone launches right in. They call it SAMming it, like a SAM missile. But
Sidearm missile.
Yeah, that's just an instant disaster. And so the best thing to do is like stay off, you know, on the outskirts of the field and come in from the outside of the field. You'll never get launched into that way. The other thing is, you will also, if you have a plane break when you launch, you will never launch it into somebody and hurt them. And that has happened too. I have broken many planes on launch, and there's been a few really close cases where I've almost hit somebody and it scared me. So if you launch out of the field and never towards the pits or the crowd where everybody's sitting, never launch straight at them. Always launch at an angle away from them if you can. And there's sometimes, and if you do have to launch at the pits, do it from the other side of the field. So if the plane was to crack up in the air or hit something, it wouldn't make it to the crowd. So, you know, we want to be safe while we're doing this too.
Right. So there's the other side of the SAM equation. Like if you're launching, it's nice to be able to just take a quick look around before you launch, know your surrounding. You got to be very, very aware in a DLG event, because as you said, everyone's coming in from all different directions, right? Everyone tries to launch into the wind. That's probably another unwritten rule that you should be doing. You should be launching into the wind, either for safety because everyone's launching in the same direction, or because of launch height. If you're launching into the wind, you know, you're going to be launching higher. But quite often when you're coming in for landing, you might not be coming into the wind all the time. I mean, you would try to, because that leads you up to your launch, but sometimes you're simply not in the position to do so. The other thing is when you're launching, as you said, if you have to launch towards the pit, maybe the wind is blowing straight from there, then yeah, just take a few steps back. Make sure, you know, even if something does fail, you're not going to hurt someone with the plane.
Yeah, it's really important. And it's an easy thing to do. It just comes with time. Actually, usually the worst way to learn it is to learn it the hard way. And that's how everybody learns. And I've learned it the hard way. And I know you have too. So the hard way is the expensive way, unfortunately. But it does happen. You know, midairs happen and you do lose some planes on launch. I mean, people launch their planes with their flaps down. That's another disaster. You know, when you're a beginner, You don't even think about it. Yeah, see, this brings up this horrible memory. But, you know, I remember I went to a contest a long time ago. It was a big one back in the day. It was called the Polecat, and it was back.
That's before my time.
Yeah, before your time. And I remember I just got a new Blaster One, the old Blaster, and I was so happy about it. And it was during the beginning. And I came in and I was going to try to do a quick turn. I had no business doing a quick turn, and we'll probably talk about that later. I had no business even trying, but everyone else is doing it. I can do it too, you know? And I was just horrible. I was horrible. And I came in and I somehow got hold of the peg. I can't believe it. I caught the peg, and I'm going to turn around and rip this plane. It's going to be awesome. And my flaps are down, and I ripped it right into the dirt right in front of me. And it just splintered into glitter. I was so sad, but it was one of those learning things. So don't launch with your flaps down. It's a horrible thing. So, and it's just, when you're a novice pilot, I would, take a little more time, think about what you're doing. Like, you know, as the plane's coming in, you'll notice that, look around, take a look. If you're a novice pilot, don't try to do the quick turnaround. Try to land it right next to you.
For,
so the blade.
For those who don't know what a quick turnaround is,
that's a good point.
During an event, to minimize the amount of time that you drop, that's not going to be in your score, you would catch the plane by the wingtip, and then you would launch it all in one same rotation or action. So that's what a quick turnaround is.
Right. So, and lots of bad things happen when you're learning that. Lots of bad things happen. So, and still to this day, it's something I have to practice. I constantly have to practice that because it's not like riding a bike. You get sloppy at it if you don't practice it all the time.
Absolutely.
And so as you practice and as the season goes on, you get better and better. And then the season ends because I live in Ohio and it snows. The season ends, and then in the spring I start all over again. And it's not like I lose it all, but I do lose my timing, and I lose it's just basically you lose your timing. But I would say for a novice pilot, I would say try to worry about your launch is number one, your safety of your launch, and then worry about where you're going to go, and have a plan, and then start worrying about your quick turnarounds.
Yeah. And when it's your first few contests, score is something you shouldn't even look at. Like you're not there to be competitive at the very top level. You're there to really get a feel for the rhythm, meet people, learn things, and just have a good time.
Right. And, and keep your investment safe. That plane cost you, even if you bought a used one.
They're expensive.
Yeah. This is a
really expensive hobby.
It is expensive, but it's so fun and rewarding. It to me, it's worth it.
Absolutely.
I would think, it's worth it. So your first contest, just to kind of wrap that up, first contest, number one thing I would say would be watch and listen. Ask a lot of questions. Never be too bashful to ask, because there's going to be a lot of people, and they all think they're the best. That's who we are.
So, Gavin thinks he's the best, but right. I'm pretty sure I knew him the last time we flew together.
They can't. You might have. And then ask some questions, and then just listen and watch and learn. And next thing you know, you won't have to ask as many questions. But, everyone's here to help. We love seeing a new – it's such a rare kind of niche hobby that it's really neat to see someone new come into it. Is excited.
Absolutely. Just don't be afraid to ask questions.
No, right? Don't.
Yeah. When you're traveling to events, around the country, and you travel to a lot of events, as we said, what do you bring to an event? Like, is there a difference between if you're driving there, like this coming weekend, or flying? Are there different kits that you bring?
There is. We'll just talk about F3K. So there's a difference in the planes that we fly. There's some planes that are very big. There's some planes that are hand launch, and then there's other planes. We're just going to talk about F3K, which is hand launch planes. When I travel by car, there's a couple things that you have to have. Shade. You want shade unless you've know somebody and they're going to be in an event and they're going to have a canopy for you, or there's a pavilion you can be under. But being under shade is an important thing because you're there for 48 hours basically, and it gets hot and you will dehydrate. Yeah. A cooler, you know, I haven't even talked about the planes yet. Let's just talk about the necessities. You need a chair. You need to sit down because you're going to want to run around, because I'm horrible about that, running around and wanting to talk to everybody. And then by the end of the weekend, I'm wore out. A chair, a cooler, a canopy, and then your gear. Talking about the gear, multiple planes if you can afford them, even if one's a used plane or, you know, or a hand-me-down plane, you need a multiple planes because you're always one accident away from having to get your second plane out or third plane. And some people have done that. I've seen planes, well, I've seen myself go through two planes in a contest, and it's a horrible feeling, but you want to keep flying because you're having so much fun. So another plane makes for, you know, having your other plane. Having your planes trimmed so that you can go to your next plane and it's just like your other plane that you just lost or you just switched up or whatever. So now that you have in storing your planes, you have to have something to store them in to travel with because they do not do well. You can't just like the glider that I can see behind you. It doesn't do well just being pushed into the car together. It's all the damage.
Get apart. You want to put it in a box, you know, away from the tables and chairs sliding around inside your car.
Right. You have to protect it. Even if it's in a cardboard box, that's fine. But, you know, take it apart. Unless you have a big, big vehicle or something, take it apart, protect it. And they get damaged so easily just bumping them around. So now that you've got your box and your plane, then you have to have something to charge it with. You have to have to charge the battery. So I use when I drive. Some people just use their car battery. They have a charger, they open up their hood, and they charge off their car battery, and that's fine. And some people have a dedicated charger, and they use a bigger LiPo, and they charge it. Some people bring a car battery, but some way to charge your plane, and some way, or a spare battery for your radio. The last thing you want to do is be walking out on the field and realize yet your transmitter is about to die. It's panic mode. You instantly get freaked out. You're like, you don't know what to do, because transmitters take some time. So either have a spare battery or a spare transmitter or a way to charge your transmitter quickly or a way to keep it charged throughout the day. So that would be, and then something to drink, something to eat if they're not providing food, you know, so you can stay hydrated and stay, you know, something to eat. But, and then the other thing would be I would have a small assortment of glue, tape, stuff to fix a plane with if, you know, that's later on. But that would be, that would be later on. The bare necessities I've already mentioned is what you need. Yeah.
So what would you not bring out of that list if you're flying? So obviously you can't bring a canopy. You probably can't bring chairs.
Yeah. So when I fly to when I'm going to Phoenix, I would, RC Groups, for you don't know, is a online forum, and they have a glider section, and you can, once you meet friends, you can have a friend and say, hey, do you mind if I sit into your canopy in Phoenix while I'm there? Because I can't take a canopy. And guys that are in town love to host guys that are out of town. Sometimes you can stay at their house or, you know, stay with them in their RV or camp with them. But so, and you can't take a car battery with you, of course. So you're going to need something to charge with. So you can charge off your rental car if you wanted to, the battery on your rental car. Or you could have somebody bring you a battery, or you could share a battery with them. That's part of the whole fun of making friends. You know, they're glad to help you. When you travel by plane, it is really important that your case that your planes are in, because you have a considerable investment in this, can get through the airport safely. People have lost so much money in planes because TSA, the Transportation Safety Authorities, or whoever they are, will rifle through your box and break your tails, your wingtips, break your nose cones, trying to get them apart. So that
they'll squeeze it.
Yeah.
The nicer
your plane box is. And there's a lot of information out there on how to store your planes. The nicer your plane box is, and the easier for the TSA to open it up and look and sniff it with their sniffer, whatever that does, the safer your planes are going to be. So when you travel, you can't take big giant LiPos with you. They're going to take them at the airport. But your transmitter case, I always take my transmitter case with me on the plane. And my planes always go in the belly. You can't take them on the plane. They're too big. And then I carry a backpack or roll around suitcase with my clothes and everything and some supplies. and then I have my transmitter case, and make sure you don't have screwdrivers, anything that's sharp. All that stuff needs to be with the planes in a container that won't rattle around and beat your planes up. And then everything else needs to be in your transmitter case. So you have to, when you fly to an event, you have to travel pretty light, and you have to have some help when you get there. Some people sometimes need to bring you something if you don't have it. I've gone to events where I didn't have any aircraft batteries at all. I had to, you know, call somebody and say, hey, could you bring me a couple of batteries for my planes? Because about 8 years ago, they weren't allowing LiPos to fly at all. We were having a real hard time getting LiPos, on the plane, even in the belly. They weren't allowing them, but now they are. So they've realized that they're not just catching on fire all the time.
Just to expand on what you said about, like, you know, storing your models when you're traveling, going on a plane. One of the things is just make sure that it's very, very easy for them to put it back together.
Right.
You can make a very strong box, but it can be so complicated that only you know how to put it together. They're not going to care. They're just going to throw everything in. They'll smash it all in. They'll close the box. That's it. So you have to make it really foolproof. Now, in the past, people were using Sport Tube 3. So if you're, and people are still using it, right? If you have like a full-size wing, one piece full-size wing that doesn't come apart, then you're probably going to be using a Sport Tube 3. And make sure you have a little box inside the Sport Tube, because otherwise it can collapse. Mm-hmm. But that's a really popular choice. It's easy to put together. Right now, there are a lot of planes out there that have removable, like, two-piece wings. And so you can use a shorter case. I'm using a Pelican. I think it's a 1720 or 1780. So it's just a bit over a meter long. And it's also very, very easy to take apart and put back together if they open it up to check.
Mm-hmm. And they're going to open it up and check. Don't think that they're not. They're going to open it up and
check.
Don't
take your chances.
No.
They're more than likely that
to open it up. And the other thing is the wing bags the plane comes in, and a little bit of bubble wrap goes a long way. In the beginning, we used to fill our boxes full of peanuts, and we would pack the whole plane in with peanuts, and we thought it was safer. Well, because they can't see into it, they're going to just rifle their hands into it, and you're going to lose a tail, you're going to lose wingtips and stuff like that, because they can't see. So the easier they can see into it and realize that it's not a threat, the safer your planes are going to be, because don't think they're not going to open up. They're going to open it up, and they're going to sniff your box. So. And that's part of traveling. Traveling to DLG events is one of the most fun things in the world. But
also the most frustrating.
Yeah, it is.
If you're flying.
Yeah, if you're flying. And when you going through customs with your planes, it really is a nightmare. So you really have to streamline your stuff down. I mean, I left China when I came to fly with you. I left China. And they found some tools in my bag that I'd forgotten about. I just shoved them in the front pocket of my backpack, and they found them. And I was like, oh, wow, I forgot about them. And they're like, what do you want to do with these? Do you want to ship them home? And I was 20 minutes from getting on a plane. I was like, no. And so they're like, okay. And they just threw them in the trash. I was like, oh, I had that screwdriver for like 10 years.
That's what they're going to do. That's what they're going to do.
They find a battery. If they find anything they don't like, it's not going on the plane, and you're never going to see it again. They're just going to throw it away or whatever. So streamlining your stuff down and just taking the bare minimum of what you need and asking for help when you get to the field, like, I need this, or I need this, I need a way to charge, is going to be much easier than trying to take too much stuff. Too much stuff is going to hinder you in the long run in traveling by air. Now, if you're driving to an event and you want to fill your whole truck up or your whole car up with everything you might think you need, including the kitchen sink, so be it, do it. That's fine. But I found that less is sometimes more at an event. You can enjoy, an event more if you're not worrying about all this stuff. And I'm guilty of taking a lot of stuff,
Okay, let's move on from there. So when you go to your first contest, you're probably going to see people, going out to fly in pairs. Mm-hmm. Right? You're going to have one guy who's going to be flying the plane, and you're going to be having someone beside him with a stopwatch, a clipboard or something. So what happens is, at a contest, there's going to be a guy who's flying, and then you're going to have a caller. So that second person is called a caller or a helper. And essentially, their role is to help you time and to help you call air. And by calling air, what that really means is just telling you where's good air, where it's bad, what other planes are doing. Now, Gavin, you've been flying events for a very long time. And what is one of the thing? What are some of the things that you look for when you want someone to call for you?
Well, that's a long, long question. We could spend a whole show on just the timer.
we're running out of time as it is.
Right. What I look for is there's a couple things. You can look at it a lot of different ways. In some ways, it sounds good. Some ways, it sounds bad. But I always try to pick somebody that knows my capabilities. And so for me to have a novice pilot go out with me, it's great for the novice pilot because he's going to get to go out with a really good pilot and he's going to see what I'm doing. But it's also, he's not going to be able to give me much help because his abilities are not at the same level as mine. So there's going to be things that I'm going to require that he's not even going to know about. And so the other thing is personalities work really well too. There's some guys that you just really click with and they know you, you know them. So they time really well for you and you time really well for them. What I look for in a timer is I look for someone that's going to keep me calm. I get fairly excited on the field at times. So I have timers that I know this, you know, this guy standing next to me, he's not going to let me screw up. He's got my back no matter what. So I look for those kind of people. But as a new pilot, I would try to get the best pilot on the field to time for me if you click with him. Now, if he's just a jerk, then he's not going to help you. But if you can get a pro to walk out there with you, you're going to learn a lot more every round than somebody who's at your equal skill level. You know what I'm saying? If you can get someone who's pretty seasoned and knows what's going on, he's going to help you succeed far more than if you just took, let's say somebody's wife out there just to click the stopwatch. That's not going to be any help to you at all. Mm-hmm. But a seasoned pro going out with you, you're going to learn a lot really quickly. And so that's what I would look for being a new pilot. I would try to get the best timer I could each time I went out and just ask. And sometimes you'll walk up to a pilot that's tired and they're just like, oh man, could you find someone else? No, they're not being disrespectful. They're just tired because they might have been out 5 or 6 or 7 rounds straight in a row and they need to sit down too. And so as you get better, you'll notice that you get asked to time a lot more. And sometimes you have to say no. So don't take offense to that. Just say, okay, I'll get you next time. And they will. They'll get you next time. But they might just be tired. So that's what I look for. But how about in Poway 2016?
I know where this is going.
I remember timing. Wow. I remember timing for you. And let's just start it out. Thomas is in the flyoffs and I am not. So that's painful enough. So Thomas asked me to time for him for the flyoffs, which is really an honor. I mean, it's an honor to be asked to time for someone in the flyoffs. So, right. So Thomas is flying. He's way out over the mountains in Poway, if you've ever been there. It's a neat field, very dynamic. And we start walking. And the grass is mowed out to a certain place to where the weeds are higher. And so we walk out to the edge of the grass and Thomas is flying. It's a long round and pretty soon Thomas is coming back and I start counting him down saying, 30 seconds left and 20 and 19, and we start walking. And right about, I think it was about 5 seconds when we realized we're 50 feet out of bounds. And that was my job.
I don't think we ever realized we were out of bounds.
Until you caught the plane? Yeah.
Until we caught the plane.
Yeah, until we caught the plane. And someone yelled, you're out of bounds. Yeah, we thought the edge of the grass wasn't. And so as a timer, that was my job to make sure that you knew where the out of bounds, because you're looking up at your plane. You don't need to be looking down constantly. You had to have, you need to have an awareness of where the field boundaries are, but I totally blew it for you in the flyoffs.
Surprisingly, you're not the worst timer I've ever had, and
that's hard to imagine.
We'll have that guest on maybe next episode or something.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
I think we both know who we're talking about.
NW. But so that's a timer, and there's so many. I think the timing aspect of it should go to another. I think that should go to another whole, because that could be a whole episode all in itself.
Yeah, timing. There's a lot of minute details in being a good caller that it's definitely going to take over the 30 minutes. I think we're well over 30 minutes for our first episode. We're going to get a little bit better in controlling time for future episodes, but it is what it is.
Just edit this whole face out, you know, and just have like one of those blurred, like I'm from the government or something, just blur my face out and you just barely hear my voice. That would be perfect. But just to kind of recap, I think as a new pilot going to a contest, try not to be intimidated. Try to ask a lot of questions. Even if you think they might be stupid, they're not stupid.
We've all been there.
Yeah, every one of us. And we know what you're going through. We definitely know what you're going through. And the other thing I say, as you go out and you start to fly in a contest, take your time. Don't rush. Because rushing leads to disasters. And it only takes one slip up of a launch or one thing. And your plane that you bought is now ruined. So take your time. Ask a lot of questions. Listen. Watch. You know, ask to be timed by really good pilots. And everybody wants new pilots to succeed so that we can compete against them, you know, later on.
All right, Gavin. So it's been awesome chatting with you. I'm really happy to see contests and, you know, events popping back up around the world. We've gone quite a bit over time, so let's call it a wrap. Big thank you for joining us on our very first episode of Camber Up.
I had a great time. I can't believe it's been we've been talking for a while now, but it's amazing. You start rambling on and it goes as quick as it does.
I'm sure you're going to be on our channel again to chat again very soon. Thank you everyone for tuning in, and we'll see you in the next video.